Welcome to Central Coast Voices. It's a program addressing the consequences of change and how today's choices impact tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It's made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Chris Kington Barker is hosting the program today while still practicing recommendations for safe physical distancing. Her guests are joining her on Zoom. We do encourage you to participate by sending us your questions or comments by email, voices@kcbx.org, or you can call them in at area code 805-549-8855. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Carol. Dr. Mark H. Morial, president and CEO for the National Urban League, described racism as the pandemic within the pandemic. In the State of Black America 2020 Executive Summary Report released in August, the National Urban League reported that Black Americans are infected with COVID-19 at least three times the rate of white Americans. And research suggests that African Americans and other communities of color appear to be at greater risk of serious illness and death from COVID-19 due to a history of racism that creates differences in health and access and care to other resources needed for good health. My guests for today's show are Isaac Garrett, Vice President for the Martin Luther King Jr. Committee of Santa Barbara. The MLKSB is the acronym for that. And we have Kemba Lawrence, the Community Services Director for Communify, formerly known as CAC, and she has joined us today as well. And I am really glad that we're going to have this discussion today, because we're also going to be talking an awful lot about community housing and how that's affecting communities of color. And this show also is going to be addressing not only in a broader sense about communities of color and some of the disparity that is encountered, but also it's a show that is focused on the Santa Barbara community, which is a great thing to do. We talk often about San Luis Obispo County, and Santa Barbara County is very much a part of our community. And I welcome you both, Kemba and Isaac, to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You know, I think it would be a great thing for both of you to talk a little bit about your organizations from the standpoint of what you would like individuals to know about the services that you're providing. So if you don't mind, Kemba, I'm going to go ahead and start with you about your organization. And you just recently changed your name, did you not?
Yes, we did. On September 1st, we did a rebranding launch of our agency. This had been in the works for well over a year and a half. We were taking the opportunity to kind of reflect on all of the services we had done, our relationships within the community. And we thought the rebranding would be a great opportunity to combine both our revised mission statement, as well as reintroduce our agency to the community. We have been Community Action had been in the community for well over 50 years. And so we had forged a lot of relationships, established a lot of programs, and also had been a springboard for a lot of different organization programs. So this past September, we relaunched ourselves as Communify. Basically, our goal is to, in collaboration with a lot of our partners in the community, we want to help our families reach their goals as far as self-sufficiency and do our part in combating poverty for families who are facing financial and other socioeconomic issues. And so a lot of our programs are specifically designed to address those issues. Some of the programs we have everyone might be familiar with, we do have the Head Start program for the county. We have about roughly 28 to 30 facilities throughout the county. We also have our senior nutrition program, which is currently, as a result of the pandemic, feeding over 800 seniors on a regular basis, providing them with healthy lunches through the senior nutrition program. We also have our community services department, which I am in charge of. And under that program, we have the home weatherization and utility of payment assistance program. We also have our senior home repair program that we're offering through that department. And we're also the agency that is administering the countywide 211. And we also have a family and youth services program where we offer assistance to at-risk youth through various projects for teen youth, GED classes, behavior wellness, mental health counseling, and various programs to help with the youth in our community. So we've been around for 50 years, but it really was time for us to bring all of those different programs together and highlight them and let everybody know exactly that Communitify is here to help with the stabilization of families and helping them get to the next level by addressing a multitude of needs.
And I'm curious about that. Was that a name that you engaged the community in to identify and to
collect? Yes. Yes, absolutely. We did. That's why it wasn't a fly by night or instantaneous decision. We thought long and hard. We actually conducted several focus groups. We had also reached out and had discussions with our funders, and it was something that we definitely thought long and hard about. But it was really great to get into the community and find out, hey, what do you know about us? What can we do to maybe help others learn about us and make sure that our reach is far wide, because we do have such a diverse programs in our fold. It was really important that we strategized to make sure that we were doing something that lined up with our vision and addressing community needs at the same time.
That's fantastic. And we're gonna come back to you after Isaac introduces himself. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about one of the programs or some of the services you talked about that Communitify offers, which really is around the housing and the housing needs of individuals in Santa Barbara County. And we're going to talk more in depth about that in just a few minutes. And Isaac, I'm going to go over to you. Can you talk a little bit more about the MLK SB and how long you've been around? And you know, I think people are certainly familiar with MLK, but how does it play within this community and your organization?
Yes, certainly. I'd be glad to. After Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, birthday became a holiday, there were several members in the Afro-American community, the late Shirley Kennedy, Sojourner Kincaid Roe, and a few others. They would have a program on that day, basically, but there was no official organization for a continuation. So each year you would perhaps have different members putting the program together. Huh. One of the pastors, Dr. Parsons at AME Church, called together a few of the Afro-American community leaders and asked them if they felt that it was worth putting an organization together to have a continuation of programs. And as a result of that, we did meet, and over a period of time, we did organize. And as a mission statement, what we said was, we wanted to foster positive relationships between the many diverse groups in the Santa Barbara community and surrounding areas to support programs and events which exemplified the teachings of Dr. Martin Luther King and to observe and celebrate the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. We had our first program in 2008. Our programs consist of a morning program at Delagara Plaza. Then we organized a march from Delgado Plaza up State Street to the Arlington Theater for a program there. And after that program, it ends, we goes over to the United Methodist Church on Annapurna and Garden Street for a luncheon. That is the program for that specific day. However, we do have other programs as well. Included in the Arlington Theater program, we do have an essay contest. We do from students of the school district, where we do give awards, prizes. We also have a speaker. We acknowledge and honor certain members of our community as well. In addition to that program, we do have programs other than just Martin Luther King Jr. We do have the Eternal Flame out at UCSB, which we honor and we start on Thursday. We have had a number of other programs that we have had. We have also co-sponsored programs with other groups. We also, this year, had a march. We assimilated a march that took place down in Alabama back in 1965, Open City College. We also have had a number of years whereby we did co-sponsor Movies That Matters at the Granada Theater, which we move usually involve some real things that Black Americans had accomplished. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the programs that we have been involved in. We also sponsored farms during the crisis of the Trayvon Martin incident, also the Michael Brown incident, where we sponsored farms to allow the community to come and seek information and to provide information that they have. And at least we provided a platform for them to be able to speak their opinion.
That's an amazing amount. Have you found, Isaac, that this year there's been more attendance and more interest by individuals through the communities to participate or to have information than there have been in the past?
Yes. We have people that's continually seeking information, you know, regarding current events, especially some of the crisis. This year at our Delgado platform, we extended participation to the audience themselves and allow them to come up and give thanks to individuals or a group, to someone they felt that had been assistance to them, had been advantageous to them in the past. And it was surprising me how many people came up and who they was thanking for.
That's fantastic.
Assisted them.
Oh, that's great. How long have you been with the organization, the vice president of the organization, or with it?
Well, I was one of the original organizers. And I was also the chairman of the committee that wrote the mission statement. And I have been the president. And I've served on the board since its inception, and I'm now vice president.
That's fantastic. And what was it that moved you to do this, Isaac?
Well, I've been a community involvement all my life, basically all my senior life. I had been president of the NAACP for a number of years. I served on the county grand jury. I chaired the commission there. And I knew the impact that we could have if we tried to bring people together, because in my former positions, it was a matter of contesting injustices that had already been perpetrated, basically. And I felt that this would be a point whereby maybe if we could eliminate some of the animosity between the different groups, that would be beneficial as well.
Are you finding that the people that are responding and that are curious are from all different ages, or do you find that it's more leaning toward one age or another?
It's from all different ages, from all different groups, basically.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for that. And Kemba, I'm going to get back to you here. What, something that I had pointed out when we had started was we were going to talk a bit about some of the services that your organization offers, and it has to do with housing. Can you please first address some of the issues that you're seeing in Santa Barbara County around issues of housing for individuals of color? And how that, you know, how is that not remarkable for Santa Barbara County in that it's carried out through all communities of color through the nation?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to make a notation that prior to COVID, African-American and people of color in our county were definitely on the higher end as far as rent burden. The definition of rent burden would be any family who's paying more than 30% of their income towards rent. And that was very prevalent in our community. Average poverty rate for our county was roughly anywhere about 15%, but then African Americans and Latinx were experiencing a 21% and a 19% poverty rate. So the housing burden has always been an issue, but it's really exacerbated because of the extremely high rental cost. And so what we're seeing is the potential, in conjunction with these families having very service industry related jobs that have all been now eliminated as a result of COVID, they are now combined with the rent and potential eviction that might be coming as a result of, at some point, the moratorium ending. So we're seeing a lot of need as far as rental assistance and trying to stabilize housing, which has been proven that if you have stable housing, it also directly affects your mental as well as your physical health. So it's really important that the county and other nonprofits establish a very strong partnership and in stabilizing housing and trying to prevent the eviction pitfall that could happen to these families. So some of the things that we're doing as an agency is we're engaging and having conversations with other organizations to see how can we best serve the families that are in need that are coming to us. Rental assistance, of course, is top on the list. So we have a family self-sufficiency program that has been awarded funding through the CARES program that is going to be used to help to provide rental assistance and to prevent evictions for those families while they are in the transition period for COVID. And in the transition period could be anything from going back to work or to retool or re-educate as they're trying to reposition themselves for some of the industry changes that in jobs that have gone away. So we do offer rental assistance as well as assistance with education in the form of fees or buying computers or something that might need it to be helped get that family to the next level as far as education and stabilization. We also, as I mentioned, have our utility program, which helps to pay for utility bills for those who are in danger of being shut off or for families who just want to get ahead so that they can have some extra funds to go to some more needed household needs. So those are two of the programs.
I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener supported radio station. My guests today are Isaac Garrett and Vice President of the Martin Luther King Jr. Committee of Santa Barbara, and also Kemba Lawrence, Community Services Director for Communify, formerly known as CAC. She has joined us. And then coming on the line with us also is Dr. Charlotte Gulick-Moore, adult health nurse practitioner, and Kemba Lawrence, community services director with Community Action Commission of Santa Barbara County, or now as it's known, Communify. And welcome to you, Dr. Gulick-Moore. Nice that you can join us as well. And I'm going to get back to you real quick. Oh, I do want to say that if you have any questions or comments about today's show or that you want to ask the guests, you can email them to voices@kcbx.org, or you can call them to Carol, and she is receiving them at 805-549-8855. Kemba, I'm getting back to you. Are the services of Communify that are for housing assistance or for rent assistance, are they pretty widely known, or is that something that really needs improvement?
They're not really widely known because it is, unfortunately, a very limited pool. So a lot of it is departmental referrals, as well as our partners who are aware of it. So, but it is there. We are constantly on the lookout for additional funds that can help. The county has some funding, so I think it's important to always engage with the 211 to find out what programs are out there and what new opportunities are being presented. But it's not a widely known because, unfortunately, it's from a limited pool of funds.
How helpful was the CARES Act in kind of assisting with this for people? Has that pretty much run out in terms of its usefulness, or is there still funding available through that for individuals?
There is some funding, but again, it's going very quickly. So unfortunately, we could always use more. The amount of that would be needed is not even been calculated yet, but it's definitely been a help. But I think the true results of it, how helpful it has been, we really are still trying to gauge it. But it's been very helpful for stabilizing, but it's just still not enough.
If somebody was listening to this station and wanted to be able to lend some assistance, some financial assistance, could they do that? And how would
Absolutely. They? Yes. We are always looking for donations, financial support, any type of funding opportunity. If they're interested in participating, we are definitely accepting that.
You know, one of the things that came to mind as you were talking about the lack of housing that's available for communities of color, or that it's, you know, the incomes tend to be lower in some cases, and the rent is so extraordinarily high in some places in Santa Barbara County. How much of an impact, or has it had an impact, of something like gentrification as well? And does that show up right now?
From the studies I've seen, gentrification has been a major issue. It has been one of the main reasons that the African-American population, as well as the population of color, has been on the decline. The county did a study basically showing that the African-American population is not even slated to even increase over the next 20 years. There's no real projections. And also because of unaffordability, there has been a pretty large drop in the population between of residents between 25 and 44, because those are the ages that you want to purchase homes and start to establish families. And it's just not affordable here. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely prevalent, and it's and the lack of housing will always be an issue. I know the governor has a very aggressive housing plan as far as building and construction, but you know, being able to keep up with that and to reach pace is a burden that the county has to actually face and address. Also the types of housing, we need larger housing for larger bedrooms, four bedrooms, et cetera. That's what is really needed as far as being able to keep up with the pace of the families that the larger families that are finding themselves not able to afford or maintain housing.
One of the things that we've heard, for instance, in Santa Barbara County, when they've talked about the governor's plan for affordable housing, is how far behind that plan we are in San Luis Obispo County. Is Santa Barbara County also really far behind that plan?
Yes, they are. I don't know the percentage that they are off by, but yes, they are behind as well. So again, like I said, it's a very aggressive plan by the governor, and that's definitely one of the burdens the county has been facing, is trying to find the methods and the plans and the process and of building at the pace that is needed, as well as maintaining and keeping it affordable.
When we talk about affordable housing, too, something that has happened when we start relating this back to the COVID pandemic, you know, and how it has been affecting communities of color exponentially, not only in terms of health risk or anything else, but also with unaffordable housing, where you've got more people who have to share rent, or you've got more people living in housing together in order to be able to afford it. Doesn't that have an impact as well?
Absolutely. And also, too, there should be some concerns, because what we have seen in people coming to our organization, not all of the units or the housing are in the best quality to begin with. And then coupled with families that are just struggling and desperate, it makes it a big, it definitely has an impact on the quality. It definitely has an impact on the increased rate of any potential spreading of COVID in those families. And as we get closer and closer to eviction, families are going to be forced out of their homes, forced to double up. And that will also create problems as well. It's safety concerns for multi-generational families that are living together, families, people who might not necessarily be families. There's increased potential for child abuse in those situations, not to mention the mental effects that it has on a lot of those who are being forced into these situations that are not necessarily in their best interest.
Yeah. And I would imagine also that there, you know, when you've got such limited housing, individuals are going to be forced to accept much, much under standard housing as well, which is a health risk in itself, from its HVAC system to just the standards of the systems that they're living with them.
Absolutely. 100%. That is definitely a really major concern. And I think that's something that has to be taken into consideration as housing plans are being created, to also hold accountable the landlords as well as the property management entities, to make sure that the housing that they are renting is up to par and is up to standard for these families. Because now more than ever, safe, affordable housing is incredibly important. Because again, we all know that stable housing affects both your mental as well as your physical. And anything that is done to destabilize that will put an additional burden on both the medical as well as the mental health industry.
Absolutely. And I want to introduce Dr. Charlotte Gulup-Moore, adult health nurse practitioner, Kemba Lawrence Community Services Director with Communify. And thank you for coming on. I know you're all busy people. I appreciate you being here. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk a little bit about coming into this is if you can talk about the impact of COVID-19, it really seems to be important to start talking about how this pandemic illustrates both biases in our healthcare system. I think it's really illuminated that to a point where it's undeniable for people that hadn't been able to necessarily see it before. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, what has happened is that with this pandemic, it's really put a spotlight on the inequity issues in terms of healthcare access and also just being able to remain safe and compliant to said recommendations. So when the virus was first detectable and the regulations and recommendations were not as stringent as they are now, with the requirements of wearing a mask and social distancing and disinfecting high touch surface areas. But before we even got to that, they implemented the shelter in place. And what was not talked about or even noticed, sheltering in place is a privilege.
Yeah.
It really is, because number one, if you are not able to work from home because of your type of job, and as we know, a lot of Black people Indigenous people and people of color, a large portion, depending on the geographical location, a good 25% of the workforce is that category of people, and they're not able to work from home. Your clerk at your local Vons cannot work from home. Right. Your registered nurse, although I'm a nurse practitioner, I'm able to work from home, but your registered nurse cannot work from home. And so sheltering in place is a privilege, and we didn't quite take that into account. We just were told to just stay home. Okay. And so now you're asking people who have to work because they're paycheck to paycheck, not necessarily that they are someone with chronic conditions or someone who's not compliant, but they just can't stay home. And so now they're in the environment. And then if you can recall early on, there were certain, well, if you didn't travel in the past, said 14 days, you're not at risk, but what if you're the cleaning person of the person who travels? Yeah. And once you go and you answer that questionnaire and say, no, I haven't traveled, but have the same symptoms, you were not eligible to get tested. So you went home and now you expose unnecessarily, not only your family, but you're in community, which translate to why we see such high numbers with Black people, Indigenous people, and people of color with higher positive rates of COVID compared to other populations. And so this pandemic has really shown a light, and it's not so much the haves and the have-nots, is that we really didn't think about the impact on the various social economic levels and the various jobs out there. And now that that's come to light, because we're asking ourselves, well, how did this happen? Why did this happen? We just did not have a good plan in place to mitigate unnecessary exposure to reduce some of the numbers that we see now. And now we're kind of backpedaling. And frankly, it's a little too late.
Yeah.
I answered your question.
No, you gave a great answer to that question, because I think it's a more illuminating answer than we usually get. We're going to take a brief break and we'll be back, because I've got some more questions for your illumination.
Thank you.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices with Chris Kington Barker. You're invited to be a part of today's discussion by adding your questions or comments to the conversation. We're unable to receive your calls live. However, you can email us to voice@kcbx.org or call them in to us at 805-549-8855. We'll be right back. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices with host Chris Kington Barker. And I'm going to remind you again that the calls live don't work with Zoom. So, but you can still join the conversation. You can email them at voice@kcbx.org, or you can call us here at the station, 805-549-8855. All right, back to you, Chris.
Thank you. And if you just recently joined us, we are visiting today with Isaac Garrett, who is the Vice President of the Martin Luther King Jr. Committee of Santa Barbara, Dr. Charlotte Galoop Moore, Adult Health Nurse Practitioner, and Kemba Lawrence Community Services Director with Communify. It's a new name for CAP in Santa Barbara County, and also Kemba Lawrence Community Services Director for Communify. And we're talking with Dr. Charlotte Galoop Moore, and so all of you guys have great answers to these questions, but I'm going to go back to you and Dr. Moore. And one of the things that was also illuminated by the COVID, and it not something that hadn't happened before, but initially individuals of color, especially in the Black community, were not getting tested for COVID. You talked a little bit about how that wasn't happening initially because things like they were answering, no, I haven't been traveling out of the country, so they weren't qualified for COVID testing. But there also was a reluctance to be tested. Can you talk a little bit about how historically that's consistent?
I believe the reluctance is the outcome to many variables that we can discuss. I don't think we have enough time to discuss all the reasons why. Historically, as you know and may not be aware, a lot of people refer to the Tuskegee experiment. That is the most well-known reason or example of the misusage of healthcare to synthesize how to provide a form of treatment in terms of the syphilis condition. And it just left a really bad, it created a very bad precedent within the Black community, along with all the other experimental activities that the medical industry implemented on Black people. And so you have the historical component of the mistrust. And then you also have the component of, well, if you're known to utilize us as, lack of better terms, guinea pigs, why would I trust or believe that you have my best interest in mind? Not only that, when you go into a major hospital, when you go into a outpatient clinic, when you go to the pharmacy, you are most likely not going to see anyone that looks like you. Meaning you're not going to see a Black pharmacist. Most likely you will not see a Black nurse. Most likely you will not have a Black doctor or a Black pediatrician or a Black gastroenterologist or a Black cardiologist, not unless you go and you proactively look for someone of color, indigenous, or identify as a person of color. And so if there's a historical component that it, I find it hard to trust the medical industry, and then there's no one there that looks like me, how do you know you understand me? The nuances, okay? And then when you look at the therapeutic and whether it's traditional or non-traditional, and if there was some type of research around it to become FDA approved, and you look at the clinical trials, the population size, whether it's randomized or not, will have probably less than 2% of Black people or people of color. So how do we know that drug really works for someone that is not identified as white and or Caucasian? And a lot of times some of these medications don't work well for us because it wasn't developed to work well for us because we were not a part of the clinical trials. Yes, we can do better by joining these clinical trials. I believe moving forward to help strengthen that trust and redirect how we provide access to care for everyone on an equitable level, we have to take it back to the basics and make sure that these healthcare institutions and academia are making not only space, but a pathway for students to enter these professions so that they can take care of like-for-like patient population. Yeah. And also diversify the experience for the clinician. Don't have a clinical rotation for your med student or for your nursing student, and it's only one type of patient population. That's not realistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the reason why there's a lack of Black people, Indigenous people, people of color going to get tested, there's multiple variables out there, some that you can modify and some that are extraneous that you really, frankly, can't do anything about.
Yeah. They also found in studies with regard to early treatment of COVID that when individuals of color were being treated, they tended to receive less treatment. They tended to receive less responsive treatment. And this is documented. This isn't anagorical, right? This is
you're absolutely correct. I don't mean to stop you, but you're absolutely correct. I am fully aware of this actually happening here in certain institutions. I know for a fact that I know of certain Black people who are symptomatic who wind up going to at least 5 emergency departments before they were taken seriously enough to be even considered to be hospitalized to receive treatment. And that person only got noticed because they knew a nurse practitioner to call the hospital and speak up for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, when we talk about this, and when I've talked with individuals who've worked in the healthcare industry, I think it's, you know, it's especially when they're not clinicians who are of color, it comes as a shock to them that this extends even to pediatric patients.
Absolutely.
That pediatric patients also, like adults, will be undertreated for pain. I mean, and statistically, they've done survey after survey of this. Mm-hmm. And they'll get fewer diagnostic tests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm an adult nurse practitioner, so I can't speak to the pediatric population for a reason. But I can tell you that even prior to this pandemic, if you look at the data, Black people, Indigenous people, and people of color are treated, are less likely to receive treatment initially in terms of diabetes management, hypertension management. Look at your rate of the mortality rate of breast cancer and the mortality rate related to it with Black women versus non-Black women. Mortality rates of almost every disease process, and that is because we are not getting pre-screened appropriately, or we're not getting the necessary treatment adequately and in a timely manner.
How do we get more individuals into education systems so that the individuals who are healthcare providers begin to look more like the communities that are coming in?
It's a multi-tier issue that needs to be addressed. It's not something you can try to fix at a college entry level because you're too late. So you need to start as early as pre-kindergarten. That's all about equitable access. The way the world is designed, you're not going to be able to make everything equal. And I get that. And that's not what I'm trying to convey. But what I'm saying is there are things that have been structurally implemented to prevent certain pockets of population from not even just having access. So, for instance, there's a woman who is facing charges because she lied about her zip code so her child can go to a school where they have a better form of education. And she just wants to give her child better education because, as you know, education is another form of wealth. And so by giving your child the education, they're able to do well. They have less stress factors. With every level of education is related to an optimal level of health and wealth. And now that child can successfully go to high school, do well in high school, then successfully go to college. And now that child can go and successfully have a career path. But when you are in an environment where the school is inadequate and the environment is inflicted with environmental injustices and environmental issues of climate condition and pollution, you have the external stress, you have the internal stress. How are they going to excel in school when they don't have enough to eat? You don't have the adequate resources to teach them. How are they going to thrive? So you're already at a minus before you can even reach third grade, which is why they have the, parochial to prison pipeline. They can tell by the number of students, I believe by third grade, how many prisons they are going to require. Why is that? Because strategically, my beliefs that they have analyzed that data and they see that when you have a certain number of minorities by the age of three, you may need a certain number of prisons. Why is that? Why can't we take those dollars, reroute them, and provide the resources necessary so we wouldn't have so many prisons? So it's a multi-variable, complex solution. And it's going to have to be readdressed and revamped from so many different angles. But the discussion that we're having now is the beginning stages. But I tell you, we're a little behind the ball even having discussions in these solidarity letters. We need action. We need purposeful, sustainable action.
And do you see any of that happening?
Yes and no. Yes and no, depending on what day you ask me. No, <I'm> just...
I know. After yesterday, it's a hard day to say yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad we are having this today. It's like a debrief from it. It's a shame. It's a shame. I do see it happening. Is it enough? We all know the answer, no. Does more need to be done? Absolutely, yes. We need to ask ourselves, what are our own biases? And we need to stop perpetuating racist antics and actions. We can no longer be silent and complacent. We have to stop perpetuating it. And if we don't stop it, it's just only going to get worse.
What is your biggest challenge in your practice with your patients?
My biggest challenge when I'm not wearing my faculty, and pardon me, I am teaching today, and so I'm in my faculty professor attire. But when I am a clinician, I have two battles. Battle number one is, how do I get through to my patient who is already judging me and my level of competency? And this is almost with every patient encounter. There is some level of judgment just because I am a Black woman. And I have to make sure that I am able to kind of sift through that so I can provide my patient with the best care possible.
Is that so for all patients of all colors?
I would say that I get that from mostly my white patients. And in some days, it's really hard, it's really hurtful, but I sift through it. I do, because it's in my heart to provide an optimal level or help my patient. achieve an optimal level of health and wellness, and how they perceive me based on the color of my skin, I frankly don't care, because that's not my problem. That's their problem. My issue is, how can I help you become a healthier person? Because clearly you're seeking that. That's why you're my patient today. But I have to go through the sift of their level of ideology so I can give them the best possible care. That is my challenge. Every day.
And as an instructor, what's your biggest challenge?
I am new at as an instructor, so it's I don't really have much to go on. I don't have children, so so having to instruct younger people is interesting. It's interesting, but again, I'm doing something I love, so it's not hard. I'm just sharing what was given to me. I'm giving back what a profession has given me, because it's not for me to keep. So I'm very intuitive to people as a clinician. So I kind of put that on my student, and I see where their aches are, and I try to identify and help them understand that's not going to help you become a safe and proficient clinician. Let me show you how it's done.
Well, we have a question from a caller that we're going to go to with Carol.
Yes. And let's see. Her name is Dina. She's from Santa Barbara. And she called to share that there is still grant money available for rental assistance in the unincorporated areas of Santa Barbara. And it's a partnership between the County of Santa Barbara and United Way. And it's CARES money. And you can find out more by going to unitedwaysb.org. Look under COVID. And she gave us a call from the 805-549-8855 number to share that.
Okay, great. And we're starting to come toward the end of our show. So before we do that, that's a good segue back to Kemba for a moment. And Kemba, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what Dr. Gillette Moore was talking about in the service industry and housing? Can you kind of expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of follow up with Dr. Moore was saying, there was a lot of Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I just wanted to follow up with just what Dr. Moore was saying, that prior to COVID, there was an extreme burden on people of color as far as housing was concerned. And so as far as the industry of service industry, which was the hardest hit, it's going to definitely only get exacerbated. So there was a study done that basically said about 28,200 renters will have at least one worker in our county that has been affected by that. And having that type of number, and this was, again, this was a study that was done around April. So we know it's only gotten an increase since then. We're looking at about $19 million in unpaid or lost rent. So even as the CARES dollars come in, there will continue to be a need. And also to talk to the pre-existing systemic housing discrimination and redlining and gentrification, all of that was going on prior to COVID. So this entire potential eviction cliff is only going to put Black people, people of color, in an even more dire position as far as being able to find stabilized housing and to be able to maintain their mental health as well as their physical health in the face of this pandemic.
You know, the other thing that I did read too in a study that came out is that for individuals of color as well, that, you know, they are more at risk for losing their homes than the white community as well. And so that's, you know, in areas where you've got difficulty with housing, difficulty with lower incomes, and there's a big delta between the two, the being able to make up for lost wages just isn't possible. So that's also going to be coming up as well. And Isaac, I'm going to go over to you. I wanted to put a message out to encourage people to call if they have questions or they just want to connect. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, yes. Although we do not provide counseling and we do not advocate for or against, but we are open to listen to individuals. If they feel that they need to vent, we would rather have them to talk to us than to go out and commit violence, as we see some of the things that's happening out in the community today. So we would like for them to know that at least we will have a listening ear if anyone would like to talk to us. We won't guarantee you get the answer you want, or we will solve the problem, but we will allow you to vent.
That's a good information to have, and probably you'll be able to understand the issues as well. Yeah. And maybe have a better conversation about that. Thank you for that. And going back to you, Dr. Moore, how do you encourage people to get into different kinds of medical practices, reaching out to consider? I know that nursing is something that it's hard to recruit people into nursing. They see what nurses are going for right now and going through right now. It's pretty hard to sell that one, even from the hero aspect. That gets a little worn. How do you encourage people to get into the healthcare industry? Because we're going to need a lot more people with all us baby boomers coming through.
Absolutely, absolutely. Anything related to healthcare, I would say this: don't do it if it's not in your heart and you truly don't believe that is something that you can do. I don't think anyone should force this profession on themselves, and don't look at it as, it is a profession that I can quickly go to college, and as soon as I come out, I can make this much money. It's not the purpose for becoming a healthcare provider. And I know I probably shouldn't say that, but I see a lot of people entering nursing. You see these billboards, come go and do my 18-month program and you can make $60,000 in 18 months. Well, okay, but then this is a person who don't like to talk to people, don't want to touch anyone's bodily fluids, and they're only in it for the money. And so that is not the ideal person. But if you are someone who is passionate and you know you want to give back, please reach out to any of us and ask us, how did we do it? And if that person is not approachable, ask someone else. Ask me. You can find me on social media. If you don't mind a plug, I'm at Moore in Health on Twitter, Moore in Health on Instagram, and Moore in Health on Facebook. That's with two O's and an E. And I will help you, because we need people who want to be here. We want you.
Thank you. I want to thank my guest today, Isaac Garrett, Vice President, Martin Luther King Jr. Committee, Dr. Charlotte Gallup Moore, with the Community Services Director with Communify, and also Adult Nurse Health Nurse Practitioner, and Kemba Lawrence, Community Services Director for Communify. And Fred Monroe will be joining us next week as your host. This show has been brought to you by KCBX and in collaboration with the Community Health Foundation, San Luis Community Foundation. And Joan Geller Sargent has been our gracious underwriter. I'm Chris Kington Barker. Thank you for joining us.
That was Central Coast Voices. And if you have questions, maybe someone offered some contact information or something that you would like to hear again, voices@kcbx.org. That's where to go. Chris Kington Barker has gathered all that information and will have it available for you.